The former Soviet Empire has always fascinated Matthew Brzezinski. Years ago, his Polish family escaped communism and settled in America. His uncle, Zbigniew, went on to become Jimmy Carter's national security advisor. Matthew wanted a first-hand look at the old empire, and so he moved to Warsaw and lived there for 5 years. Then he moved to Ukraine, where he hoped to make his name as a journalist. Brzezinski writes about his experience in his book Casino Moscow. He told Steve Paulson things got off to a rocky start.
I guess I was a little naive when I first moved to Kiev, because shortly after taking a furnished apartment there, I had a knock at the door. I opened it, and there was this very sort of prim and proper-looking young lady. She looked actually like the sort of stereotypical librarian, very meek, big sort of round horn-rimmed glasses and hair sort of neatly tucked into a bun. And she explained that she was a student, and she had known the previous tenants, and she'd left a textbook there. And there was exams coming up, and would I mind if she had a look for it? And I said, sure, go ahead, you know, take a look. But the next thing I know, right behind her emerges this guy who looked like a rhinoceros, very short and extremely stocky. And lo and behold, he's holding a gun in this tattooed hand. And it took a couple of seconds for me to figure out, oh my God, I'm in big trouble. Well, they sort of backpedaled me into the living room and hogtied me. And of course, then the first question they asked was, well, where's your money?
They had gone after you because you were American. They figured you were rich.
Absolutely. Everybody, the day that I moved into this building, everybody knew that I was a foreigner. And in fact, when I'd go to throw out the garbage, people would come and start rummaging through it, and little old ladies would even fight over it because they figured that as a Westerner, that even my trash had to sort of contain buried treasures.
So there you were in your apartment, hogtied, a guy waving a gun around. This must have been pretty scary.
Oh, it was absolutely terrifying. The scariest part of the whole thing was that I knew I had no money on me. And he was expecting that I would have thousands of dollars tucked away under the floorboards because it's a local custom over there that no one trusts banks. And he thinks I'm holding out on him. And this is what's really, really scary, that what do I have to do to convince this guy that I don't have thousands of dollars? Because he's gone through quite a bit of effort to set me up and to come here, and he doesn't seem like the type who takes disappointment very well. They start tearing up the apartment while he punches me and kicks me in the ribs and sort of tries to force me to disclose where I've got the money hidden. And it's your head, because this is taking a lot of time. And this takes as much as, I think it was around 45 minutes, although I didn't have a watch with me, they stole my watch. But your head starts playing games with you. And the worst was that we had heard the stories of what happened to other Westerners, particularly in Moscow. And there was the case of one British accountant whom they tortured with a hot iron, and they just started ironing his chest.
Oh, my God.
And he survived this, but suffered a nervous breakdown and spent 6 months in a sanatorium in the UK. And there was, of course, the really tragic incident of a consultant to the World Bank who was tortured in his bathtub and essentially drowned in his own blood. That, for me, was the scariest, because after 40 or 45 minutes, I'm not exactly sure, the thug lost his patience and dragged me into the bathtub. And then he pulled out my own Swiss Army knife that he put to my throat. And quite frankly, I thought that that was it. I guess I was less than heroic, and my sort of whimperings and pleas convinced him that if I had any money, I certainly wasn't holding out any longer, because he made off with, instead of thousands of dollars, they ended up stealing my favorite pair of jeans. So this was my sort of introduction to capitalism and the capitalist transition in the former Soviet Union.
But you were extremely lucky, as it turned out.
I was extremely lucky, yes. Ironically, that incident sort of helped make my career, because I wrote about it, and I tried to write about it in a sort of amusing way for the Wall Street Journal, and they liked it, so this got me some attention, and eventually I landed a job with them, and they bumped me up to the Moscow Bureau.
Now, you've mentioned how some Westerners have been attacked, have been assaulted, and some have been killed, but I would imagine that most of the violence happening in the former Soviet Union is happening against, for the most part, Russians themselves. And weren't the mid-90s especially bloody?
Oh, extraordinarily bloody. It was, for Americans, I guess the closest thing to an analogy would be sort of Al Capone's Chicago. You know, one has to remember that up until 1991, everything in Russia was owned by the state. Russia was an extraordinarily wealthy nation in terms of natural resources, dripping with oil, diamonds, gold, platinum, palladium, nickel, you name it, they had it, and they had huge quantities of it. This had belonged to no one. And all of a sudden, 1991 comes, and there's sort of this directive, well, okay, time for capitalism, anybody can own this. And there was a free-for-all, and it was very Darwinian in the sense that it was the strongest, the most politically connected, and often the most ruthless who were able to grab this.
So what does that mean? There were shootings on the street, that kind of thing?
Oh, in the early 90s in Moscow during what was known as the Great Mob War, I think the overall murder for Russia in 1993 was 30 or 40,000 people killed.
Wow.
You know, this was when gangs and businessmen and the lines between legitimate businessmen and out-and-out gangster criminals were very, very blurred. You had 300 top bankers killed in 1 year alone. This was because there were no laws. There was no rule of law. And a lot of the legislation, a lot of the civil codes, they were written under communism, and they no longer were applicable.
And this must have been a gold mine for a journalist. And you started out as a stringer for the Wall Street Journal and then became a staff writer. But I'm wondering if there were some stories that were just considered too outrageous for your editors to publish.
It wasn't so much that stories were considered too outrageous. It's that certain stories we couldn't do. One of my colleagues at the Journal, she had worked for a major American newsweekly before in Moscow, and they were preparing a story about the mayor of Moscow and one of the oligarchs who the mayor did a lot of business with. And they were going to disclose some of the shenanigans that were going on. Well, two thugs with guns came to the bureau, this very, very large American newsweekly, and pulled out the guns and explained to them that, you know, Moscow can be a very dangerous place and it wouldn't be a very good idea for them to be snooping around on stories.
They walked right into an American news bureau and pulled
with guns. With guns. And so, you know, obviously the story was killed, and there are unwritten rules in Russia, and you have to follow them at your peril if you don't. You know, in the case of Westerners who did die, and sometimes they would just be in the wrong place at the wrong time. They'd be sitting in a cafe in St. Petersburg when it just so happened that some gang members were sitting in that same restaurant, and a rival gang would come in and just, you know, machine gun the whole place, and they would pass away. Those were very unfortunate incidents. But the Americans that did find themselves in trouble, that were either murdered or disappeared and their bodies were never found, were often in business and sort of violated some of these rules. And it was because of business disputes.
How much of this is Moscow, and how much of this applies to the rest of Russia?
Oh, Moscow is another planet from the rest of Russia. And Muscovites like to brag that to see the real Russia, you have to go outside the Beltway in Moscow. Moscow is sort of like a giant sponge that sucks the entire wealth of the nation. And all you have to do is go 20 miles outside of the capital, and you are in the deep, deep third world. And I traveled all across the empire, going all the way to the Pacific, to Vladivostok, which is the big port, and to the Siberian oil provinces, which are extraordinarily wealthy. These are sort of their equivalents of Alaska's Prudhoe Bay. And I was horrified at the conditions at the oil fields, where they're extracting hundreds of billions of dollars of oil and exporting it for hard currency. A lot of the people didn't have electricity because the local powers that be decided that there was an electricity shortage, and they needed the electricity to run the oil derricks, the extraction pumps. And so the residents and the workers went without electricity. And Siberia is a place where you need electricity. You need heat.
Is there any labor unrest? Do the workers ever rise up and revolt?
No, that's one of the things that I just could not understand about Russia. That how is it that people who go unpaid, people who have to suffer through humiliation and indignity, why do they take it? Why do they allow this country to have the leaders? I'm perhaps oversimplifying, but an answer is that the Russian people have been so browbeaten. Stalin murdered, no one knows the exact number, but 30 million people. Another 10 probably died during the Second World War. The best and brightest immigrated at any opportunity that they had. And, you know, the population has just is just so tired and exhausted and preoccupied with just daily survival that they just don't have the energy to protest.
Matthew Brzezinski is the author of Casino Moscow. He spoke with Steve Paulson.